This is a show about all things food, and you are tuned in to Free Radio Santa Cruz. When we're on the air, it's 101.1 FM in Santa Cruz, and anywhere you are in the world, you can listen at freakradio.org. And I want to welcome all the listeners to today's show. On today's show, I am going to play a talk by the author Raj Patel, and he is the author of a book called Stuffed and Starved. It looks at, the subtitle is The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. It looks at the inequities of the world food system from the beginning to the end of the conventional food chain, from producers to manufacturers and distributors to consumers. And what else can I tell you about it? That's about it. This talk is called The Real Price of Food. And if you would like to hear, I'm going to play the first half on today's show, and then I'll play the second half on next week's show. And if you would like to hear the talk in its entirety, it is on YouTube. You can just look for Raj Patel on YouTube, and you can also get a link to this talk. Well, there's two things. You can go to my Facebook page, which is Your Homegrown Food Show, and I have a link to the talk there. But it's also at www.coa.edu. And I guess that's who hosted Raj Patel and put on this talk. So here we go. Here's Raj Patel talking about the real price of food.
I want to talk about the sort of current state of the food system. And the state is not good. Today we live in a world where there are a billion people who are overweight and a billion people who are starving. The food crisis that we saw really erupt a couple of years ago, it had some proximate causes that by now should be familiar. You know, the reason that the price of food went up was partly because of the price of oil. And I think here we're all familiar with the fact that the way that we grow food today is hostage to fossil fuel. The average American consumes, in the way that they eat today, roughly 2,000 liters of fossil fuel, of gasoline equivalent, every year, and that's both in the transport of the food, in the fertilizers that are used to grow that food, and you know the energy that's required to irrigate that food, and so on. So when the price of oil goes up, the price of food goes up. But there are other reasons why the price of food went through the roof. One of those reasons was the use of biofuels. Biofuels, if you're not familiar with it, is the marvelous idea that we should grow food not in order to eat it, but to set it on fire. And this is the sort of driving idea behind biofuels. And we can talk about whether they're a good idea or not, and you might be able to guess my opinion on that. In addition to that, of course, you have increasing levels of meat consumption around the world. When George Bush, bless him, was trying to explain the food crisis, he said, the reason the price has gone up is because those people in India are demanding things, and when the middle class demand things, the price goes up. Now, one of his aides parsed this for us. What the president meant was that when more and more Indians demand meat, then the price, because there are a billion Indians, then the price of meat is obviously going to go up. Now, in a sense, of course, you can understand the logic of this argument, that there are, in fact, you know, that there are a billion Indians, and were they to demand more meat, the price of meat would go up. And if the price of meat, when there's more demand for meat, there's more demand for the feed that goes into that meat. And then there's more stress on the land as a result of that. The price of the feed crops go up, and therefore, you know, you can imagine that the price of food goes up as a result. Trouble is, of course, India is a Hindu country, and so it's a little hard to imagine that everyone is. And you're just like, Jagdish, do you fancy a Big Mac? Yes! You know, it's not entirely how it played out. Now, it's true, however, that in India and in China, there is more demand for... I mean, in India, the demand really is for milk. And in China, there has been increasing demand for meat. But it's not as if everyone yesterday decided that what they wanted was a ham sandwich and a glass of milk. This process has been a long, gradual process. And if you want to look to the sort of eye of the storm of meat consumption, one needs to look really at the United States, where if the whole world were to consume the amount of meat that the United States does, it would take seven planets to provide the feed for that meat. And research done in the United Kingdom suggests that in a future that is wise about climate change and is wise about equity, the amount of meat that we would be able to consume, if everyone were to consume the same amount, would be about one pork chop a week and enough milk for cereal, and that's it. There's certainly something interesting to what George Bush was saying about meat, but it wasn't where he thought it was happening. Actually, the problem lies much closer to home. In addition to that, we've had, we can talk about the oil, we can talk about the biofuels, we can talk about the meat. We can also just talk about weird climatic things happening. The harvests were disrupted to a great degree over the past couple of years by strange climatic events. But those climatic events were compounded by public policy choices. Public policy choices like, for example, the price of rice went up by 30% in a single day. And that had everything to do with the way the Philippines government, for example, started buying rice at a higher price on the global market. And the global market, I think, is the key to understanding the deeper causes of the food system's malaise and to understanding the price of food. Because one of the other reasons why the price of food went through the roof was because of speculation and trade. Trade where grain traders were able to hedge their bets, and they knew that the price of food would be going up. They shifted all their investments away from fossil fuels into the futures markets for food. And you saw a great deal of speculation on the price of food. And that meant that some people, that we saw an outbreak around the world of food riots, so-called food riots. Actually, riot is the wrong word. Riot suggests that it's a bunch of mindless people tearing through the street. And in fact, what we saw was not the sort of an angry mob, but a very articulate mob. In every food riot that has happened, certainly in the past couple of years, you've seen a demand for food linked to a demand for political change. And we'll come back to that at the end of this talk, because the understanding of the political change that's necessary in order for us to get to the true price of food is one that I think we need to appreciate a lot more. But this sort of list of reasons why the food system's not doing well sounds a little abstract. So let's take it to the simplest and most sort of fundamental level of where most Americans meet their food. And most Americans meet their food really at the checkout counter. You know, after the supermarket, you go there and, for example, at a fast food joint, you will go in and you will order a brand hamburger and they will charge you $4 for it. Now, that seems pretty cheap. But actually, the machinations of the market behind that hamburger are such that cheap food is, in fact, cheat food. Cheap food is a way of shuffling away the true costs that go into everything that we eat and masking the true burdens of where those costs fall. So let's take that hamburger. If that hamburger was grown on pasture that once used to be rainforest, then there is a dollar value associated to the destruction of rainforest that attaches to the hamburger. Because rainforest provides a range of ecological services, right? The rainforest does work, not only in terms of carbon sequestration and producing oxygen and being part of various hydrological cycles and being a haven for biodiversity, but all of that has a dollar value. And according to the Center for Sustainability and the Environment in India, for every hamburger that's grown in this tremendously unsustainable way, the true cost of a $4 hamburger is nearer $200. $200 per hamburger. And that's just for the ecological costs, the ecological footprint associated with, you know, with this cheap food that turns out to be cheat food. Now, I mean, there are other costs on top of that. I mean, if you think about the healthcare costs that are associated with you know, the consumption of junk food, if you think about the taxes that that Americans pay in order to give the Small Business Administration the revenue to be able to pay McDonald's to be in communities. I mean, you know, McDonald's and a range of other fast food joints are classified as small businesses, and they are entitled to loans from the federal government because of the enriching nature of local small business. So the costs are huge. And I want to suggest that actually that's something that we should be looking at. We should be looking at why we have markets in food at all. Because markets in food, I mean, when we're talking about sort of, you know, the $200 hamburger, we could be talking about anything in our food system that traverses the world, that we have food that's available, you know, around the clock, from out of season in the sort of perfect presentation at the supermarket. And we need to ask how that came about. Now, it's easy enough to say, look, you know, the fast food corporations are gaming the system, and they're manipulating markets to be able to drive down prices elsewhere so that we get our cheap food and they make a great deal of profit. But the interesting question is not, why do corporations game the system? We know that corporations will game the system. I mean, that's how we've set up markets, right? We've set them up so that corporations will externalize as much of the costs as they can and try and maximize their revenue. That's the rules of the game. But the interesting question is not why corporations behave badly. It's why we allow markets in food at all. And to answer that question, I think we need to go back and look at the history of markets. And really to think about the international market in any agricultural product, let's look at one of the world's first agricultural markets. The world's first agricultural market, really a global market, was the global market in wheat. And that's really only 130 years old. It's not a new thing. Sorry, it's not an old thing. I mean, 130 years old is really pretty young in the history of agriculture. And really, the ground zero for that is India. And I want to draw on the work of historian Mike Davis, who's done a great deal of very important work here. But Mike Davis observed that, India was a feudal country. You had landlords and you had peasants. And the landlords would exploit the peasants. It was horrible. But there was a kind of moral economy, so that under this, you know, ancient feudal system, when bad things happened, when the rains didn't come, when there was disease, when the crops failed, it was the landlord's responsibility to feed the peasants. Right, so it's not. It's an awful system, but it's mitigated in some, to some extent, by this moral economy. Now, when the British arrived in India, they saw landlords feeding the serfs for free in bad years, and the British said, "No, you don't want to be giving stuff away for free. You need markets, and when you bring markets in food, you'll find that productivity will go through the roof." When you buy and sell your labor, you will be able to allocate resources much more efficiently. You'll produce more food than ever before, and everyone will win. And the landlord said, "Actually, no, thanks. We're fine. We're doing well." And the British said, "No, we have guns." And so it was. It's a rather abbreviated history, but it was often through the barrel of a gun that the British imposed markets in grain in India. And to some extent, the British did not lie. After the imposition of these markets in grain, in the golden age of liberal capitalism, India produced more grain than it ever had in its history. More grain per person than ever before. Millions of tons of grain were exported from India to Britain, to the workshop of the world, where it there became the first kind of first example of cheap food that was in fact cheat food, because the cheat happened in India, because When you introduce markets in food, you introduce two simple rules. The first rule is that if you have money, you get to get the food. And in Britain, the workers in the workshop of the world had money with which to buy food from India. So you can get food when, even if the food comes from halfway around the world, if you have a market, you can make that happen. But the second rule is this, that if you have no money, you will starve. And so in India, as a result of the imposition of markets, you have stories of people loading bags of grain destined for Liverpool and Manchester, and those people loading the grain onto the trains, and they themselves would perish of hunger, even though there was more food per person than ever before in history. And Mike Davis has dug out an astounding fact, one that caused no end of embarrassment when it was publicised in Victorian Britain, that in the 2,000 years before the British came to India, in the two millennia of recorded history, there was a famine once every 120 years. In other words, you have to wait for over a century, if you were in the time of famine, over a century for the next one to happen. But after the British came, and after markets were introduced, and after the golden age of liberal capitalism, there was a famine once every 4 years. From over once a century to once every 4 years. Now, India is, I mean, one doesn't want to sort of belabor India as an example, but, I mean, well, what was happening in India in Victorian times was happening around the world. And again, Davis calculates that about 30 million people died so that we could have international markets in food. And India today is also the sort of poster child for the contradictions of a market-driven food system. Because in the 1990s, India liberalized its economy. And as a result of this liberalization merely means that the market was brought in to deal with the sorts of things that previously the state had done. India had fought famine by having a public distribution system, a system where cheap food was available to any Indian who wanted it. And that system was replaced in the 1990s by a far more sort of market-driven system. And the supports for farmers, the subsidies and sort of governmental support for farmers were also cut back when the market was brought in. Capital restrictions were liberalized as well. In other words, there was a great deal of influx of money into India as a result of this liberalization. And of course, not just money, but also new products came to India when the economy was liberalized. Now, as a consequence of these liberalization policies, four things have happened in India. First, India is now, or last year was, not this year, last year was home to the largest number of billionaires in the Forbes top 10 billionaires list. More than America, more than China, more than Europe, India. Four of the top 10 richest men were Indian. At the same time, levels of hunger among the poorest people in India have started to increase. The number of farmer suicides in India has reached epidemic proportions. And India is now home to the largest number of people with type 2 diabetes. And all of these are linked. They're linked to this policy of liberalization because the capital inflows made a few men in India who could control the resources tremendously rich. I mean, the men who are the richest men in the world now were already big industrialists in pre-liberalization India. And they were able to make a great deal of money with the influx of new capital. On top of that, you're seeing levels of hunger go up among the poor, obviously, because the resources that are geared to alleviating hunger have been shrunk. On top of that, you're seeing farmers, this epidemic of farmer suicides is linked to the encroachment of the market, and particularly with debt. Farmers in India and around the world have a very similar story, where particularly small family farms becoming increasingly unsustainable in the current economic climate. When there's so much cheat food going on, the people who really pay the full costs of everything find themselves buried by an avalanche of debt. And so they'll go into debt, and then there will be some event, that in better times people would have been able to navigate. You know, a medical expense, someone in the family gets married, the rains don't come, the crops fail. And in better times you'd be able to sort that out. But when you are buried by debt, some farmers have despaired and taken their own lives. That's happened in India, of course, but it happens around the world. There's been an outbreak of farmer suicides in Australia. In Britain, of course, foot and mouth disease was accompanied by a wave of suicides as well. And of course, the final thing is this type 2 diabetes epidemic. And that's really a cultural phenomenon. In India before liberalization, India didn't have Coke or Pepsi. It had Thumbs Up, which was a sort of domestic version. I don't know if any of you have been to India and tried Thumbs Up. It's an acquired taste. So all of a sudden, sort of Coke and Pepsi came in, and there's a nice little anthropological anecdote here. I mean, when Coke came in the 1990s, they came with their global Coke advertisement. I'm not sure if you remember this. It was the polar bears. You remember the polar bears? And the polar bears, and they flip off the top of the Coke bottle. No opposing thumbs, but nonetheless. And they sort of lean back and watch the northern lights. So I'm not sure if any of you are familiar with Indian cultural iconography. But polar bears are not big. In India, people watched these adverts in the cinema or on TV, and they said, well, "What the fuck's that?" Pepsi kind of got it right. Pepsi hired the Bollywood A-list, so cut back when the market was brought in. Capital restrictions were liberalized as well. In other words, there was a great deal of influx of money into India as a result of this liberalization. And of course, not just money, but also new products came to India when the economy was liberalized. Now, as a consequence of these liberalization policies, four things have happened in India. First, India is now, or last year was, not this year, last year was home to the largest number of billionaires in the Forbes top 10 billionaires list. More than America, more than China, more than Europe, India. Four of the top 10 richest men were Indian. At the same time, levels of hunger among the poorest people in India have started to increase. The number of farmer suicides in India has reached epidemic proportions. And India is now home to the largest number of people with type 2 diabetes. And all of these are linked. They're linked to this policy of liberalization because the capital inflows made a few men in India who could control the resources tremendously rich. I mean, the men who are the richest men in the world now were already big industrialists in pre-liberalization India. And they were able to make a great deal of money with the influx of new capital. On top of that, you're seeing levels of hunger go up among the poor, obviously, because the resources that are geared to alleviating hunger have been shrunk.